Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Happy days are here again because we have Peterson Toscano and his compatriots at Citizens Climate Radio sitting in for me to share their quarterly contribution to Spirit in Action. I could fill you in on all the stuff Peterson, Erica, Horace, and others will be talking about this hour, but I'll just say you'll be learning about activism, Antarctica, permitting, fashion, and refashioning, and much more. All done with the consummate skill and insight that Peterson brings to everything he does. I'll hurry right along and hand the microphone over to Peterson Toscano so that we can glory in and learn deeply via the creative talents of Citizens Climate Radio. Over to you, Peterson.
Hi, my name is Peterson Toscano, and for you listening to today's show, thank you for joining me. We're going to travel to the Antarctic. Writer Elizabeth Rush spent over 50 days on a research expedition as the writer in residence. The result is her extraordinary book, The Quickening: Creation and Community at the Ends of the Earth. Elizabeth writes about Antarctica like no one else has ever before. For one, the expedition took the crew and researchers to Thwaites Glacier. We know more about the moon than this hard-to-reach giant block of snow and melting ice. And Elizabeth tells stories about people who are often left out of the narrative. In her book, she provides a space, too, to reflect on parenthood. Should she and her husband have a second child? What does it mean to be a parent in a world that is rapidly changing? We hear from Brett Cease. He's a senior staff member at Citizens Climate Lobby. Brett also traveled to Antarctica and shares with us his eyewitness account of the beauty and fierceness of the land and the sea. In today's show, you will also meet two young people who have joined me in my production work. Horace Moe is a recent graduate of Michigan State University. He now lives in his home country of China. Erica Valdez is graduating this weekend from Northern Arizona University. Congratulations, Erica. So, thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Today, we're going to consider the four roles changemakers traditionally take. Are you an advocate, a helper, an organizer, or perhaps a rebel? Maybe you take on different roles in your work to address the causes and the impacts of climate change. Eileen Flanagan, a Quaker author, speaker, and climate change mover and shaker, will explain the four roles for us. Then, you're going to hear a lively conversation I had with two of my team members. But first, I want to introduce you to our newest Citizens Climate Radio team member, Erica Valdez.
Have you ever heard of the Inland Empire? To all the locals, this valley is a sweet spot of Southern California where you can spend time at the beach, the mountains, and the desert all in one day. To me, the Inland Empire is the region I call home. Hi everyone, my name is Erica Valdez. I'm a senior at Northern Arizona University, majoring in environmental sustainability and minoring in Spanish and community engagement. Growing up in this beautiful part of California, I spent most of my childhood outdoors, whether at the beach, on camping trips, or on the streets of my neighborhood. Staying connected to my surrounding environment became a habit. As I got older and some of my time outdoors was replaced by the news, I noticed everyone talking about climate change. Anchors used buzzwords like increasing temperatures and rising sea levels. They encouraged us to do our part by taking shorter showers and separating our recyclables. Looking back, these concerns and recommendations were going in one ear and out the other, not just for me, but for those around me. It wasn't until I did some research and I took a climate science class in high school that I realized how big of a problem this really was. My confusion quickly turned to curiosity and passion. Now, I study the environment in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is unlike the usual desert landscape that comes to mind. Instead, picture a small college town in the snowy mountains of Arizona. Here, I'm grateful to have the Coconino National Forest in my backyard. While at school, I explore the surrounding land. I also enjoy relaxing in a hammock on campus. Oh, and I recently started bouldering, but I can't say I'm the best at it. I also take advantage of living in the first dark sky city in the United States. Did you know that Flagstaff has very low light pollution? This means that the night sky is not polluted with any artificial light, and it makes for excellent stargazing. Here in northern Arizona, I'm able to recognize the importance of our environment just as I did as a kid in California. Only things are a little different now. As I've watched shifts in our climate become more intense, feelings of climate doom and anxiety have grown within me. I don't know about you, but talking and even just thinking about climate change can exhaust me, but I refuse to let it overwhelm me. Because of these feelings, I chose to learn how I can make an impact. I decided to pursue a degree in environmental sustainability. I'm committed to supporting others in this global conversation, to communicate climate change in a way that encourages, not one that creates fear or guilt, and to ensure that future generations have the opportunity to connect with their environment as I did. And I'm very excited to do this through my work with Citizens Climate Radio.
Thank you, Erica, and welcome aboard. In a moment, Erica Valdez will join Horace Moe and me for a spirited conversation about our roles in the climate movement. None of us discovers our roles right away, and our roles do grow, change, and develop over time. So what about you? What's your role on our rapidly changing planet? In 2017, we featured Eileen Flanagan. It was for episode 9 of this podcast. As the board chair of Earthquaker Action Team, or EQUATE, Eileen led a successful effort to stop one of the largest banks in the United States from financing mountaintop removal coal mining. Later, as the EQUATE campaign director, Eileen played a pivotal role in launching a global campaign against Vanguard. This is the largest investor in fossil fuels worldwide. Her dedication and leadership have made a significant impact on the fight against climate change. So I asked Eileen about the steps we can take to move the public and lawmakers to action. And she answered, "What do you know about the four roles most commonly taken on by changemakers?" And I was like, that there are four of them? Lucky for you, Eileen will break them down for us. After Eileen Flanagan explains the four roles, Erica Valdez, a college student studying change movements, will chat with me about the organizer role. This one, I have to say, is the hardest to explain. Erica goes into more details for us and provides some very inspiring examples. Horace Moe will then jump into the conversation to tell us about the role that currently best suits him. Eileen told me about Bill Moyer, who dove deep into social change movements. He then spent much of his life leading trainings around nonviolent direct action. He also identified and taught successful strategies for bringing about social change. Eileen shared with me some of Moyer's teachings about the roles we might take when seeking to change the world around us.
And he found that there were four roles that showed up over and over again. And the names we've given them are helper, advocate, organizer, and rebel. And they show up in all kinds of ways. And the way to think of it is really, what is their orientation? So a helper's orientation is, what can I do to make things better without messing with the system? So if you're concerned about climate change, a helper might insulate their home, put solar panels on, maybe do that in their congregation, try and live a low carbon footprint life. That sort of thing would be attractive to someone who's naturally a helper. An advocate takes the role of trying to use the tools of the system to change things. So lobbying, using lawsuits, trying to convince elected officials and people in power to make decisions, essentially using the tools of the system. In contrast, a rebel uses disruptive tactics. They don't do letter writing. They don't do lobbying. Instead, they do protests of various kinds. In my tradition, we usually use nonviolent direct action, targeting a decision maker, maybe a corporation, and trying to get them to change a policy through consistent troublemaking. The fourth role is called the organizer. And in some ways, the organizer is the trickiest because they can use different kinds of tactics. But the thing that makes someone an organizer is they are oriented toward their group, toward their community. So for example, someone who says, let's get our congregation together and see what we can do together about climate change. That's a very organizer way of thinking about it. And the group might decide to insulate the church, or they might decide to, you know, go lobby together, or they might take up a rebel tactic. The focus of the organizer is what will our group do? So this shows up again and again in different kinds of social change. If you think about the Montgomery bus boycott, Rosa Parks was the rebel. She got arrested for refusing to move on the bus, but there wouldn't have been a big thing if it hadn't been for the woman who stayed up all night mimeographing leaflets saying, let's all boycott the buses on Monday. She played the organizer role. She got people out. The advocate role was played by the NAACP that filed a lawsuit against the Montgomery bus system. And then helpers were the people who drove people. The ordinary citizens of Montgomery and the African-American community walked to work for over a year in order to put pressure on the bus company. They wouldn't have been able to do that without the helpers who came and gave people rides and things like that. One thing I found really helpful about the four roles is to realize that organizations play a niche, but then each organization needs in some way people who have these different strengths. So even though my group, we have helpers and they're the people who bring cookies to the meeting, and boy, are we glad that they're part of us, right? If we do civil disobedience, we need people who are thinking about taking care of people and things like that. So there's an individual level to finding out what are your gifts and proclivities that you can bring to the movement. Organizations are most effective when they pick one. An organization that tries to play all four roles is probably going to be less effective because they're jumping around too much.
I love this conversation that Eileen Flanagan has started for us. And I think a lot about these roles. There is one role, though, that I have a lot of questions about, and that's the organizer role. I understand it, but I want to understand it better. So to help me with that is our newest team member, Erica Valdez. Hey, Erica, how are you?
I'm good, Peterson.
Welcome to the show, your very first time on Citizens Climate Radio.
Yes, I'm very excited to be here.
So you've done some research for your studies, and you've looked at this organizer role. What can you share with me and with the listener to help us better understand this particular role?
Before I started my studies, I had no idea that the organizer role existed, and it was just very hard to digest. First, I want to point out that in the world of organizing, we constantly refer to this process called the cycle of organizing. Just to touch on some of the points that Eileen makes, we do look inward onto the group or into the group. We always start by connecting with the people, and this could be those in the community, those in the group, those just involved in our mission. We start by building relationships in order to identify the issues. And once we connect with these people involved, we can plan on how to support and sustain the group and build collective power. And then organizers and their group carry out the action. Organizers use similar tactics to the other four roles that we talk about, but throughout this whole cycle, it's very important to reflect and evaluate so we don't lose sight of the group vision.
The thing that I appreciate most about, and I understand the most about the organizer model, is that the organizer is not a leader in a traditional hierarchical sense, but more like a facilitator. Am I getting that right?
Exactly. You're right on point. Organizers use relational and collaborative spaces. They don't just lead all alone. They actually try to avoid one person leading and doing all the work because this could lead to potential burnout. I always ask people, have you ever had a group project and just taken the initiative to do all the work yourself? Yeah, it's very tiring, and I get over the work so fast. And this is what organizers try to avoid. Instead, they look for and identify the leaders. Yeah, they rarely lead the group alone.
Can you give us any examples of like people in history that have done this kind of work?
There are so many examples throughout history that I could talk for days about, but one that stands out to me is Ella Baker. She's a well-known activist and grassroots organizer of the U.S. United States Civil Rights Movement in the 50s and 60s. She advocated similarly to Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, but she never prioritized being the face of the movement. Instead, she introduces this term called spadework, And in this context, we refer to the spade as a gardening tool. It does a lot of the detail work to create these large, beautiful gardens. And she uses spade work to describe the behind the scenes, the nitty gritty work that keeps the momentum of the action. And often this work is not seen or recognized. And through this, she prioritized building relationships and identifying the leaders in the movement so that it would outlast her. It was a really long-lasting movement, and she didn't lead the group alone.
It's amazing you mention Ella Baker, because I just saw a movie, a biopic, that had her as one of the main characters.
Really?
Yeah, it's this new movie on Netflix called Rustin, about Bayard Rustin, who is another organizer that many people never heard of. Because like Ella Baker, he stayed behind the scenes. He also stayed behind the scenes, not just because he was an organizer, but because he was openly gay at a time when that was really hard to be and it would have tanked the movement. So he stayed in the shadows in a way. He organized the March on Washington, where Dr. King gave his famous speech, but he didn't do it himself. He had a whole team of many young people that he helped to build that leadership, to identify the leadership, just like you say. So if anyone wants to see this in action, this movie, Rustin, is great, because you see Ella Baker identifying Rustin as someone who needs to step up, and then you see him doing it, and it's lovely to see it in action. And now that you explain all this, I'm like, oh yeah, those total organizers and organizer roles.
Yeah, I think those characteristics are the most admirable of the organizer role, and we can see it in so many people throughout history.
What about you? In the work that you've done so far, what roles have you taken and which one or ones fit you best?
Before studying community organizing, I, again, had no idea that these roles existed and that like we could distinguish characteristics between them. After I started studying it, I realized that in my roles on campus, off campus, I realized I wasn't putting these things into practice when leading these groups or just being involved in these groups. And those around me were often facing a lot of burnout. Our initiatives just stopped moving forward, which is very, very common if we're not putting these things into practice. As an organizer now, and I consider myself a community organizer, I've learned the importance of building relationships and identifying leaders, evaluating the whole time. What am I doing wrong? What's working? How can I support my group better? And this has made all the difference in the groups that I'm involved in.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation from a completely other country and time zone. And for you listening, we're recording this, well, in the United States, early in the morning. What time is it by you there, Erica, right now?
It's about 8 a.m.
And joining us from China, where it's about midnight, I think, or later, is our very own Horace Mo. Hey, Horace.
Hey, Peterson.
Hey, I hear it's an auspicious day over there.
Yes, it is. Just for our listeners, you might be hearing firecrackers or fireworks that are going off right now outside my window, actually. It's the Chinese Lunar New Year, so I can't really help with that. Everybody is in a very joyful vibes. Let's get to the topic. I really agree with what Erica said about her experience as an organizer, and I think her sharings actually deepen my understanding of the work of being an organizer, even though I've never had that kind of experience before. It is really amazing work that organizers like you are doing for our social goods. I identify myself as a helper. And for our audience to know, the definition of a helper given by Eileen is what I can do to make things better. This idea strikes with me the most. It indicates doable action at an individual level. Whenever I can offer support or whatever that is needed by other people, it almost always brings me a fulfilling feeling that I am valued, and is touching to see people smiling back at me when I offer whatever help that they actually are in need. Mm. And I just enjoy this kind of interaction with people around me.
I feel very much that I'm a helper too. For you, Horace, where have you been a helper, and how have you shown yourself to be a helper?
When I was an undergrad at University of Michigan, I actually volunteered for a local sustainable food organization. What I did was pretty simple. The organization just needed people to help them hand out free vegan burgers, which were so delicious, by the way. I once had 3 burgers from the organization just for breakfast. They tried to give away free vegan burgers to promote their brand, but the most important thing is to get people interested in vegan burgers, which are great alternatives to meat-based burgers. For our listeners, gosh, if you're listening to this and you have not tried a vegan-based burger before, I strongly suggest you to try out a vegan burger, which tastes almost exactly the same as meat-based burgers. They set up a booth by the football stadium, one of those college football game days, and I just simply helped them hand out those free vegan burgers to the fans who were going to the tailgate parties. It's a simple task. I am confident that most people are able to hand out burgers.
I know that it's super difficult to remember how important these little tasks are, and they can just sometimes get muddled and forgotten in the big picture. Not everyone needs to be an Ella Baker in order to make a difference. It's these little tasks that everyone is able to do that make a very big difference in whatever mission we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And so often food is part of it, right? Preparing sandwiches or giving them out. The thing that I have found too that I'm so pleased with, I'm an introvert. So I'm super shy around people, which a lot of people don't think about because, you know, I'm very engaged on the radio. I really struggle unless I have a role. And once I have a role, and it might be handing out vegan burgers or teaching or something, I feel much more confident and able to move within society because I've got a specific role to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I also consider myself an introvert. I am not that type of person who can speak a lot or just speak loudly in front of the public or in front of a lot of strangers. Handing out vegan-based burgers is such a just like customized task for me to do because I just feel relief but also value at the same time that I can contribute to a community work that I enjoy doing.
I don't know, Eric. I'm starting to get a little suspicious that Horace is working for Big Vegan.
He's advocating pretty well for him.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm just going to be franky. That kind of opened the door for me. You know, when I was a helper for that organization, I also became a learner. I learned about the nutrients of those vegan-based burgers and what are the process of making those burgers, what are the ingredients of those burgers, and what's the difference between those vegan-based burgers and meat-based burgers, and especially the impact on our environment and the welfare of the animals. So vegan-based burgers, like I mentioned before, they're so good. You have to try if you haven't.
Yeah. You keep pushing this. Yeah, I know. I don't know. Every time, do you get like a quarter every time, a dollar every time you say that? I wonder. But, you know, as you're saying this, like you went to do this as a helper and then you learned something. And I imagine you also got to know some people. And that's the other thing that I think it's important. When we're looking to change the world or change a law or change a system, we may not always be successful. In fact, often we're not. We may have limited success at first and it takes time. But other changes happen, changes with relationships, and people get to know each other, and you network, and you find out about other groups, and you learn other things. And that's part of the change movement as well, not just the win or the lose, but the building of the community.
Yeah, and that's why I love the relational aspect of all of these roles. It creates a community that even if you try and fail, you're trying and failing together, and it might spark a new initiative. It might, again, help us network in order to just get new ideas and bounce off of each other and create collaborative spaces. And that's what I love about this work.
Horace, other than pushing vegan burgers, is there anything else you want to add?
I have to give a disclaimer. I did not get paid by saying or promoting vegan-based burgers. Yeah, I definitely echo with what you said as being an organizer. People like you also need helpers like me. And we helpers also look up to you. We just might need that kind of person who can gather people together and come up with a collective plan that we can work on something together. Each role that is played by either a helper or an organizer is equally important. Together, that would foster a very reciprocal relationship, which will definitely help people struggle for the same goal in a proper and efficient way.
Feel free to send us an email, radio@citizensclimate.org, and we'll get back to you. And if you want, you could actually be on the air, share some of your ideas. That email address again is radio@citizensclimate.org. Erica, Horace, thank you so much for being on the show today and for helping so much with the production of Citizens Climate Radio.
Thank you, Peterson and Erica. My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Super happy to be here.
This episode of Citizens Climate Radio has been brought to you by Horace's Vegan Burgers.
I appreciate it.
Do not go away. There's a lot more to come. In the second half of the show, we plunge into Arctic waters. Well, not literally. Elizabeth Rush tells us about nearly 2 months at sea and shares her strong opinions about how we talk about parenting and climate change. Oh, and during those 50-odd days, she was there without any internet. I have to say, that may have been the harshest condition she faced, although she loved it. She reads for us from her book, The Quickening. Brett Cease shares the sights, sounds, and awful smells of Antarctica. Plus, we have good news about sustainable fashion and a quick lesson about an incredibly sexy and wonky topic, permitting reform. Stay tuned.
I'm sure you've been enjoying and profiting from today's guest host for Spirit in Action, Peterson Toscano, and the other folks from Citizens Climate Radio, with more coming in the second half. Right now, I'll remind you that I'm Mark Helpsmeet. This is Spirit in Action, and our website is northernspiritradio.org, with all kinds of good stuff there, like the links to our guest hosts and guests from today, and from all of them for the past 18 and a half years. Come to northernspiritradio.org, post a comment, share our links and shows with your friends, and become part of the conversation. Check out the 35 or so radio stations across the U.S. that broadcast our programs, or track down the many places our podcasts are carried, besides our site. Do what you can to make our program sustainable with your help and your donations, and do the same for the wonderful community radio station in your town. I've said this many times before, but the reason we depend on you, our listeners, for financial support is because money from corporations and government comes with strings attached. Not all the strings are bad in themselves, but the practice tends to become a slippery slope. We want to serve your needs, and your support makes that possible. Your part as helper, organizer, leader, or participant changes the world and makes a better future possible. Enough from me right now. Back to Peterson Toscano and Citizens Climate Radio.
Hey, Erica. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Peterson. I'm happy to be here.
Congratulations. Being co-host, first time. Well done.
Thank you.
What's something you're excited about listeners hearing on today's show?
I'm especially looking forward to hearing from Elizabeth Rush. She talks about her new book, The Quickening. It's about her experience on a trip to Antarctica and how she sees this continent being impacted by humans.
Yeah, and she's an amazing writer. She'll give us a reading as well. I'm super excited about your good news story that you worked on. You researched it, you recorded it, you did all the audio, and it's about sustainable fashion. I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, me too.
Well, with this Antarctica theme, we also have a segment with Brett Cease from Citizens Climate Lobby. He traveled to Antarctica too, and he shares with us the sights, the sounds, and the smells, which I didn't realize they were so strong, in Antarctica. So, are you ready, Erica?
Yep, are you?
I think so. Let's do it. Elizabeth Rush is the author of Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Her work focuses on listening to marginalized voices in frontline climate-affected communities. And she explores the crucial questions of our responsibilities and emotional responses in a rapidly changing world. Elizabeth returns to Citizens Climate Radio to tell us about her newest book, The Quickening: Creation and Community at the Ends of the Earth.
In 2019, Elizabeth Rush joined a research expedition aboard an icebreaker to Thwaites Glacier, a remote and rapidly deteriorating region critical to understanding global sea level rise. Her book, The Quickening, documents this journey, blending awe-inspiring encounters with icebergs and intense scientific labor, while pondering the profound personal question of what it means to bring a child into a world undergoing radical change.
When I took a position on this boat as like the writer in residence, I knew that I wanted to spend a lot of time on this ship interviewing and speaking to people whose voices are traditionally left out of Antarctic stories. It turns out, as I like delved into Antarctic research, that like if you're not a wealthy white dude from the global north, like you've definitely been written out of Antarctic history. I did very purposefully spend a lot of time during the expedition talking to like the engineers and the able-bodied seamen who all came from the Philippines, the cooks on board, because our modern Antarctic stories tend to center the work of the scientists that are trying to do climate science or groundbreaking science in Antarctica. And if you just look at like the crew list on our boat, the Nathaniel B. Palmer, we were 50-50 support staff and scientists, federally funded scientists. So I was really interested in like whose labor makes the scientific discovery possible? Who aren't we hearing from? I mean, it's a book about Antarctic history. It's a book about how in the little bit of time that human beings have had contact with Antarctica, we've really like crushed this continent of ice into like a very limited masculine narrative of conquest and derring do. And Antarctica serves as like a backdrop in that story. I sometimes say it's like a deep feminist rewriting of Antarctica. A lot of these books tend to be about like extreme environments. And I was like, you know, for all the time I spent in Antarctica, the reality is most of it was inside a climate controlled boat with like four meals a day cooked for me and stuff. So I tried to kind of lean into what it was actually like and not over dramatize it. There was no choice but to be yourself. People really didn't perform for each other. There was a certain amount of like deep authenticity that being on this boat just demanded, because otherwise you would wear yourself out by like day three. I don't think I've ever been in a situation like that. The closest is sort of like summer camp when I was 10 or something. I mean, I don't know how people felt about summer camp, but I don't know. Just like there's like a deep sense of camaraderie that developed amongst us going through this like really strange experience together. I think all the characters in the book come across as very authentic, and they just kind of like shed their armor and let it all hang out. The mechanism of the book is one where you're kind of a fly on the wall, eavesdropping on really interesting people for like 2.5 months as they, I don't know, plow into the ice and like go sedate elephant seals and then play bridge for hours on end because they have nothing else to do. We had no internet, like no functional internet, which was awesome. Like you just had to be with each other. It was really fun. I think I was some of the happiest of my adult life without internet. There was none of that kind of like knee jerk, oh, I'm like standing waiting for my groceries. Let me read the newspaper. My time became way more expansive because it wasn't divided into these smaller and smaller chunks constantly, which I really, really, really liked. It was after dinner and you were sort of like, oh, I don't know what to do with myself. You're not like, well, let me just like read something on Twitter. Maybe I should walk up to the bridge and look to see if there are whales out there and maybe I'll chat with someone. I felt that there was a lot more sort of very low stakes socializing that happened. And that replaced the internet a little bit. Like it replaced Twitter, it replaced social media, but with actual human beings. It was wonderful. I really felt liberated. Experiencing something extraordinary with other human beings, there's nothing quite like it. And it doesn't have to be a glacier. It can just be a shared space. It can be a fire at the end of the day. I want to make the reader feel like they're pulling close to this glacier and looking at it and having to kind of like consider it fully, physically, spiritually. The book really doesn't tell you what to think about climate change and parenthood. Instead, I hope it creates a meaningful space for the reader to like engage in their own thinking on that quandary. It's not, you should have kids, you shouldn't have kids. There's no shoulds at all. It's just, man, this is complicated. Here are lots of ways to think about it. When I read about climate change and parenthood in the news, it often gets sort of reduced to like conversations on the carbon footprint. I'm like, oh, a kid is like your biggest contribution to your carbon footprint. And I just think that's a bunch of BS. And I could go down that rabbit hole. We don't have to right now. But choosing to have a kid is not the same as like getting a Jetta or a Prius or whatever. And I really don't appreciate the comparison because I think it denies folks the opportunity to have a real conversation about like, what does regeneration mean as the planet tips out of balance? I really wanted the book to have space for like a thoughtful conversation around those subjects without getting prescriptive.
Elizabeth agreed to read from The Quickening.
Think of this section as a monologue spoken in the voice of Peter, one of the researchers aboard the ship.
So this is Peter. I had a moment yesterday. Do you ever just stop and think, what the F am I doing? That we're about to sail to the Southern Ocean? Why would anybody in their right mind go to Antarctica, which is like the great beyond? I just had one of those moments where I went, what am I doing? I'm from Norfolk. I shouldn't be here. Most of my friends who are not scientists think I'm kind of mad. Antarctica is bad enough, but Thwaites? They look at me like, really? Is there a need? They find the fact that it's called a cruise particularly entertaining because, you know, a cruise to them means rattling around the Caribbean on the QM2 with a cocktail in hand. On our cruise, there's no alcohol. You have to share a cabin. You eat what you're given, and it's freezing bloody cold. And the thing is, you can't get off if you don't like us. If there's someone you really hate, you can't get away from them. It's the same on all the scientific cruises, no matter where you go. At breakfast, they're there. They spent all night on the same boat as you. You have no choice but to make it work. Otherwise, you'd throw yourself off the side. It may surprise you to find that I'm a quite sociable person. So to cut myself off from all my friends almost completely, well, I've got to find some sustenance somewhere. Here we are on this boat with this motley crew of people who most of us just met, and now we'll embark on this incredibly intense journey that is its own kind of social experiment. All right, and then this is arriving at Thwaites. This is the night into morning that we arrive at Thwaites. That night, sound sleep eludes me. I wake often, each time hopeful that we've arrived. Finally, around 5 o'clock in the morning, I rise, shuffle up the 4 flights of stairs, undog the door by the ice tower, and walk out on the bridge wings. The weight's gray margin wobbles in the gloaming. We wind alongside, entering small coves and rounding odd promontories, our pace slow to hold this precarious line. The ice-faced, soft as dunes. The night's new hint of darkness gives way to the bruised light of dawn, and many others appear to watch what each of us has been working toward for weeks, for years, and in some cases for decades, come into sharp focus. We don't talk. When someone wants to say something, they whisper, as though we're in a giant, roofless cathedral. We, who've been at sea for so long, finally gaze upon the glacier that has already given us one another. Rick stands attentive at the ship's helm, the captain next to him, steering us along the edges of Thwaites' unfathomable fracturing. It's hemorrhaging, heart of milk. Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Rush, author of the book The Quickening, Creation and Community at the End of the Earth. It is available wherever you get books.
To learn more about Elizabeth and her other publications, visit elizabethrush.net.
It turns out you don't need to be a fancy scientist or a creative writer to visit Antarctica. There are tourist cruises you can take. Well, not luxury cruises, but you can travel with scientists who are doing their research.
Brett Sees, Citizens Climate's Vice President of Programming, traveled to Antarctica with his father and sister. He shares some of his experiences with us, including the shocking truth about penguins.
We were on a boat called the Ushuaia, named for the city, obviously, that you leave from South America to get to the peninsula on. It's a 279-foot ice-strengthened expedition ship, specifically that was built for NOAA as a research vessel back in 1970. It tops out at about 16 miles an hour, so it goes very slowly, chugging along with its old diesel engines. It's about 52 feet wide, and there was space enough for 90 passengers and 38 crew. And it now services not only as a transportation for those scientists to get to the peninsula, but for tourists and individuals that are interested, like my family was, to go along with them and during the journey learn about the research that they're doing, get educated, and have the chance to interact with those people as we made the voyage. These were the people in the world that are doing some of the frontline research, trying to understand the changing climate of Antarctica, the early signals that we're already detecting, and the impacts that it's going to have on a whole system of food chains. Just imagine a house-sized wave crashing over your boat, the bow of the boat, every 5 to 10 seconds for 2 days straight. You literally kind of have to Velcro your head to your pillow at night, or else you'll roll off the bed. The winds and the currents swirling around, this endless surging raw power of the Southern Ocean, it felt like being at the bottom of an endless grandfather clock pendulum. It wasn't too cold. We were in the Antarctic summer. There's no darkness. That is another beautiful thing. You know, imagine being in a world of 23 hours plus of light. And yes, we, just like Elizabeth, we reveled in the chance to share and get to know the other travelers and the crew, just to get into the flow of the season and the wildlife and the quiet ice passing by us. It was unforgettable. You're struck immediately by how quickly the mountains rise up from the ocean. It's actually the highest and driest and windiest continent in the world, not just the coldest. It's known for its katabatic winds, which have speeds of over 200 miles an hour, and it's constantly there. There are three types of penguins in the Antarctic Peninsula that we all got to see during the expedition: the Gentoo penguin, the Chinstrap penguin, and the Adelie penguin. And here is where climate change rears its head. Rising temperatures on the Antarctic Peninsula are actually hammering the region's Adelie penguins and the sea ice that they depend. Ice forms continually later each year, it melts earlier, and that whole species is disappearing entirely from that peninsula. Some of the sounds that you might kind of imagine with penguins include the cooing, the beautiful squawks that they give to each other as mates. Penguins mate affectionately for life, so it was really inspiring to see both the male and the female parent take care of their young chicks and build up their stone nests with little pebbles that they'd waddle over across all the mud to collect. On top of being adorable, lovable birds that we all just enjoy looking at, penguins live in absolute squalor. This is one of the things that I wasn't prepared for. It's detailed by an NPR article that I love replicating here. They say the best way for you here at home, listener, to recreate the olfactory experience for your own nose is to take some old cigarettes, soak them in ammonia, mix in some rotten shrimp, put this all in a bottle, if you will, and then let it sit out on your windowsill in the sun for several days. Mix it up, and then take a big whiff in, and then breathe that in constantly, and that is the smell of penguin guano. Because of their sheer scale, these colonies that we visited were literally hundreds of thousands of birds. You can imagine that that gets overpowering pretty quickly. Antarctica is losing ice mass. That means it's melting. at an average rate of 150 billion tons of ice each year. Witnessing these icebergs that are floating now in the cold open channels of the ocean, hundreds and hundreds of them, we got to see icebergs calving. We got to see the ship being navigated through channels that were clogged with them. They were composed of snow that had been compacted long before I was born, long before even, on some of them, the dawn of humankind. And thinking about the impact that all of us have in changing so dramatically and so quickly this entire landscape was incredibly humbling and harrowing.
That was Brett Cease, Vice President of Programming for CCL.
Visit cclusa.org/radio to see some of Brett's photos.
Hi, I'm Dana Nucitelli, CCL Research Coordinator, and this is the Nerd Corner. I'm here to highlight some interesting new climate research for the nerds out there, and to make it understandable for the nerd curious. In this episode, we consider the question, what exactly is permitting reform, and why is it so important? A permit is how a local, state, or federal government gives the go-ahead to start a new construction project. During the permitting process, the government makes sure that the construction and operation of the project won't unduly harm workers, the local community, or the environment. That's an important process, but permitting adds time and expense to projects of all kinds, so it's important to strike the right balance. We want the permitting process to be thorough, but not take so long that it delays the critical clean energy transition. Right now, the permitting process is taking so long that if we don't make it more efficient, we won't be able to meet our national climate commitments. Electrical transmission lines are particularly important because they're needed to connect more cheap and clean solar and wind energy to the electrical grid. But new transmission lines currently take about a decade to permit and build, which is just too slow. One helpful bill that CCL has advocated for is called the Big Wires Act. It would require each region of the country to build more transmission lines connecting to their neighboring regions. A new report from MIT found that big wires would bring a lot of benefits. It would reduce climate and air pollution by allowing more clean solar and wind energy to be built and connected to the grid. It would reduce costs by allowing regions to share that cheap, clean energy with their neighbors. And it would also reduce blackouts by allowing regions to import extra electricity from their neighbors when their own power plants go down, for example, due to an extreme weather event. Passing the Big Wires Act would be a great win-win-win for the country. It's also important that in the process of streamlining permitting, we don't cut out the input of communities that would be directly affected by these infrastructure projects. But by taking steps to improve early community involvement, we can actually reduce overall project timelines by avoiding the need for time-consuming lawsuits. We just need to make sure that permitting reform is done right, and that's what CCL is working on. I'm Dana Nucitelli with the Nerd Corner. Thank you for being curious and for your commitment to climate progress. To join the discussion about climate science, technology, economics, and policy with CCL's research team, check out the Nerd Corner at cclusa.org/nerd-corner. That's cclusa.org/nerd-corner. I hope to see you there.
Do you know which of these products takes more water to produce? Is it our food, our clothing, our cars? If you guessed clothing, you're right. The fashion industry is the second most water-intensive industry in the world. To produce and package clothing takes a lot of resources, not to mention the greenhouse gas emissions it produces to transport all of them. These processes have a huge impact on the environment, and it's hard for us as individuals to steer clear from the consumer culture when things have become so accessible. The good news is that groups are stepping up to bring this issue to light and support individuals in taking action. One of these groups is the Scroungers Center for Reusable Art Parts, or SCRAP. I had a great conversation with Danielle Grant. She's a programs director at SCRAP. She told me about the background of the nonprofit and how it's empowering young people in the climate conversation. Here are some quick facts about SCRAP. It's the oldest and largest creative reuse nonprofit center in the United States. SCRAP was started in response to the defunding of arts education in the San Francisco School District, and it was established nearly 50 years ago in 1976.
At this time, the environmental movement was gaining momentum worldwide. I mean, it was the 70s. This decade brought the first Earth Day and the Environmental Protection Agency. People were advocating for the climate by sharing the science, protesting, and collaborating with others across the world. I love that Scrap is open to the public. People can shop, explore how to use materials, and attend educational workshops. What caught my attention was one of Scrap's after-school programs that teaches students how to reuse and revitalize clothing materials. This program is called Sustainable Fashion Design for Teens. In this program, students usually have two classes per week. One is more learning and curriculum-based, where they discuss the fashion industry worldwide and its environmental effects. The second is a hands-on workshop. Over 12 weeks, students work up to a final project or fashion show to present to their friends and family. Scrap's main objectives with these school programs are to 1. Keep materials out of landfills and reuse them in schools, and 2. To teach a young generation the importance of reducing waste in the fashion industry. While talking with Danielle, it's obvious that these students need these spaces. Scrap provides a space to learn and process climate information. Students not only hear about our shifting climate, but they also experience it in the Bay Area of San Francisco. They see and breathe in wildfire smoke, and they also experience a new phenomenon, the atmospheric river, bringing extreme amounts of rainfall. This is a very heavy topic, and Scrap gives them tools to cope with climate anxiety. They also get to connect with other teens and make an impact. Danielle phrased it perfectly, quote, "This program gives students a little bit of hope and agency around participating in the fight that lies ahead," end quote. Sustainable Fashion Design for Teens is just one of many programs that Scrap offers, and it's not the only one doing this work. In fact, when looking for sustainable fashion groups to feature in this episode, I found so many around the world, I had trouble narrowing it down to just one. These groups show how important individual and collective action is, and how creative it can look. Want to get involved? Scrap has worked with other reuse nonprofits to help them implement similar programs, and they're looking to collaborate in other areas and schools to create more learning opportunities like these. You can find more information about Scrap programs at scrap-sf.org. I put that link in the show notes for you, and there you can also find photos of the students' Scrap projects. Just visit cclusa.org/radio.
Thank you for spending this time with me on Spirit in Action. So would you like to connect in person with thousands of climate advocates, hear inspiring speakers, and speak directly to your members of Congress? If so, consider attending the Citizens Climate International Conference and Lobby Day in Washington, D.C. It will be in person from June 8th to the 11th. You can register by visiting cclusa.org/June Conference. Today's show was produced by me, Peterson Toscano, along with Erica Valdez and Horace Moe. We got special assistance from Mark Helps Me. Thanks, Mark. Today, you heard excerpts from my show, Citizens Climate Radio. Learn more about the show, along with the various trainings we offer, and much more. Visit cclusa.org. It's been such a pleasure spending time with you. Now, I hand the controls back to Mark Helps Me.
Thanks so much, Peterson, and I do hope that folks will reach out to Citizens Climate Radio and take action to preserve our world through Citizens Climate Lobby and all their work, ideas, and inspirations. The links are on northernspiritradio.org for all of our guests and guest hosts, and we'll see you again next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.